7:09 in the morning on Scott and BR and Billy Ray, War Stories with the Navy SEALs. In studio with us right now, U.S. Navy SEAL Lieutenant Commander Ed Rohrbach. Ed, good morning.
Morning.
How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you. So I think we told you a little bit about this. This is we got obsessed with the Navy SEALs. Sorry. We kind of look to you guys as like rock stars. Do you find that people like hear that you're a Navy SEAL and they're like, whoa, no way, Navy SEAL? Because we're kind of like that.
Yeah, you get that. You get that a lot.
You do?
Yeah. Hey, tell me a story. Yeah, I just met you. We're in line at the bank.
Get out of my face.
Hey, listen, by the time I get to the teller, can you tell me about killing people? Uh-huh. Is that possible? So you have kind of an interesting story, though, because you're the first guy that we've met who's actually a San Diego native. And the fact that SEALs are only trained and developed here in San Diego, I don't know how many guys are actually local guys that grow up wanting to be Navy SEALs. What part of San Diego are you from?
Well, I grew up in Scripps Ranch in Mira Mesa, and I went to Mira Mesa High.
Mm-hmm. And athlete in high school?
I was. I was a water polo player in high school. I played a little bit of soccer, and I swam. Did a lot of surfing.
A lot of aquatic background for a lot of SEALs we talk to. Did you find that to be the case?
Yes, we are. We're the maritime special forces for the Navy, for the entire military. So we start in the water. We oftentimes end up in the water. So we love the water.
Yeah, got to be good in the water, huh? Mm-hmm. See, that's one of the things that when we first got started with this whole series that Latrell told us about, you know, from the Lone Survivor, is that as a kid growing up, his father forced he and his brother to learn to be good swimmers. And he even tells a story in the book about his brother, like, jumping on little alligators' backs. I don't know if I'm buying that. Yeah. You know, we were giving him a hard time about it. Do you know this guy, Marcus Latrell, at all?
Yeah, everyone knows the Latrell brothers. Yeah, they're great guys, and they're fun to work with.
Are they the kind of sick guys that would jump on alligators' backs and, you know?
You feel sorry for the alligator.
Right? I'm not sure if the alligator's as big as it probably was in the story that was told you.
Yeah, but I mean, I heard.
I
like
guarantee
14
you,
footers.
They jumped on something.
Yeah. All right. So, Mira Mesa High School, and do you grow up your whole life wanting to be a Navy SEAL?
Well, we grew up. My brother and I. My brother's a SEAL as well. We grew up on stories that my dad was telling us. My dad was a frogman back in the Vietnam era, and so we grew up with these stories about these giants that he worked with. You know, and he played it. He played it well. You know, we always said, hey, we're going to be SEALs as soon as we get out of high school, as soon as we get out of college. He said, no, why don't you go on and do something else? But he would tell us these stories about these guys and these amazing things that they would do. And so you just get that in your head, and you can't get it out.
Yeah. And then as you went through your career, you're probably comparing your stories to his stories.
Oh, ours are way better.
Really?
Way better.
Wow! Really.
So your dad was, you called him a frog man.
Yes.
I don't really know what that means.
We've evolved over the time. The special warfare community in the Navy has been around since about World War II. It started with some of the amphibious landings in Europe and then and went through in the Pacific. And over the course of time, as warfare has changed and the requirements changed, we've changed our skills and capabilities. And for the most part, they were called frogmen, underwater demolition teams. Once we got into Korea and Vietnam, we started developing the SEAL teams. And their goal was to move a little bit farther past the water's edge and get in and do more type of direct action and other types of missions that are farther away from the water.
So you go from Mira Mesa High School, and you're not just joining the Navy. I mean, you went to college, right?
Yes, yeah.
You went to?
UCLA.
Uh-huh. And at UCLA, is your plan, hey, I'm at UCLA, I'm going to get a great education, and I'm going to go get a job somewhere, or did you really still think I'm going to be a Navy SEAL?
You know, in the back of my mind, I knew I wanted to do something like this, because there was part of the story. It wasn't just these great, amazing stories, but my dad really had a sense of pride of being part of something bigger, you know, and he actually made me feel like, you know what, an ordinary guy can be a part of historic events, and really all you got to do is some push-ups and make it through Hell Week. It's not too hard. And, you know, and you know, it's the typical poster. See the world, do amazing things, And then when you get in, you realize that, yeah, you are part of historic things. You are playing a key role. And so at first, you know, my brother and I think I told you the story off the air. We said, hey, we have to give this a shot. This is something that we really believe in, we really want to do. And we both started. And I intended to just do it for a short period of time. But you really feel like you're contributing. And so you just, you know, and not to mention there's all these great great times are with, you're working with these giants of men, these ordinary guys that do extraordinary things, mm-hmm. and you find yourself in situations and in places where it's funny, you almost have to giggle. You, I can't believe that we're about to do this. Or they're paying me money to do this right now.
Well, paying you money, I mean, it's like you were saying earlier, and this was, again, before you came on, but I decide I'm going to become a Navy SEAL. They're like, wait a second, I can jump out of airplanes, mm-hmm. I can blow stuff up, right. I can work out all day, yeah. and they pay me. What a life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can't, you, if, I guess it's either a quirk of my genetics, but I just don't understand why there's not a line out the door every day for kids to get into BUDS. I mean, it's, to me, it was a no-brainer.
There's not a line for kids to get into BUDS. I don't know. Maybe it has something to do with this Hell Week where, like, 95% of the guys don't make it. I mean, this BUDS Week and this Hell Week. What goes on for this?
Well, what it is it's basically, I always look at BUDS as a chance. That first phase of BUDS is the physical development phase. And I think the classroom is really yourself and the environment. It's you figuring out that you can put up with these extremes of physical exertion, no sleep, mm-hmm. and, you know, about four to six hours over the whole week. And, you know, San Diego looks good on TV. It looks sunny. But that water is cold all year long. No matter what time of year it is, it's cold. So you're always cold. You're usually wet. And it's all about you trying to figure out, like, okay, all I have to do is get to Friday. And some guys just can't make that leap to get to Friday. So it's just a way to figure out about yourself.
And do you think that the driving force was probably all the stories you heard your dad tell you as you were being raised? And then to actually get there, and then to compare everything you go through with all the stories that you have already filed in your head, that had to have been a crazy thing.
Oh, yeah. It was both a hindrance and a help. I mean, on the one hand, you hear the story of his first day of Hell Week, and then so you have these expectations, and it's never like that.
Yeah.
It's totally different. And then you start, but in the back of your head, you think, well, if my dad and my brother can do this, I'm not going to be the guy at the kitchen table during Thanksgiving that says, hey, pass a turkey, sorry, I quit BUDS. But on the other, you look at it that way, and on the other hand, you look at it and you say, well, they did it too. There's no problem me not being, this is easy. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm way smarter and bigger than both of those.
Way smarter.
All right, well, Lieutenant Commander Ed Rohrbach is in studio from the Navy SEALs. And Pratty, let's do this because I want to have max time for war stories. We've got a chance to meet him. Mira Mesa High School, UCLA alum, decides to join the Navy, wants to go and become a Navy SEAL, and has been a Navy SEAL for how many years now?
12 years. Yeah. Mm.
Been all over the world?
I've been on every single continent thanks to the Navy, except for, now which one is it? The North, is that at Antarctica? That's the continent up there?
You got me, pal. I would think that a Navy SEAL would have like a GPS attached to their head somewhere.
I think Antarctica is the one
on the bottom.
Underneath.
So,
yeah.
So,
I think.
I haven't been there.
On the top.
I haven't
it's
been there.
The Arctic.
That's Arctic.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, all right.
And then there's Antarctic.
Okay.
And then there's Uncle Arctic.
Don't know him.
I'm just kidding.
All right. So let's do this. The war stories of the Navy SEALs are next with San Diego's own Lieutenant Commander Ed Rohrbach. By the way, I think I called you Lieutenant yesterday by accident, and I didn't really know like the whole
come on, man.
You know, etiquette thing.
It's all right.
Were you offended?
No, not at all.
Did you just know that I was just some, you know, dumb civilian?
No.
Yeah.
No, it's just fine. All right. We'll make it through this.
All right, Lieutenant Commander. The war stories of the Navy SEALs coming up next on the Scott and BR Show.
Double X1090.
So I'm already getting texts from my guys. That's what's bad about being local.
Wait, your friends are starting to text you?
Already.
Lieutenant Commander Ed Rohrbach from the Navy SEALs is about to tell some war stories. I hate to, like, over-glorify the fact that these guys are busting through doors and shooting up the place. But this is, I mean, we are all so fascinated by the work that the Navy SEALs do. And, you know, one of the reasons we started this is because we really wanted to bring some exposure to the Naval Special Warfare Foundation, which helps the families of Navy SEALs who are either injured or even, you know, worst case, killed in combat. And so we'll make another $500 donation today for you being here. Thank you, Lieutenant Commander. So, all right, let's do this. We're not on the radio right now. We're hanging out. We're in a bar. We got a couple beers inside of you, Lieutenant Commander. And now we're all dying to hear the stories of what it's like to be a Navy SEAL and be over in Iraq. You've been there. What year did you go over?
I was there right at the beginning. So right after, I guess you could say the Army and the Marines met up in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. So within the first month of the war, we rolled in there.
What year are we talking about here?
2003.
Okay. So the Army and the Marines go in. Is this after the Saddam statue is pulled down?
I think about the same exact time as that.
And you guys go rolling in.
We went rolling in. There was already another SEAL force in there, and we replaced that force. So they had been in the area for a while. They conducted some of the first missions of the war, and then our job was to go in and take the positions that they were in and let them go home.
Okay, and what's the job? What are you guys there to do?
So really, when we got there, the strategic goal was to kind of mop up what had happened. We were going after the remaining members of the Iraqi regime, the Ba'ath Party members, and some of the leadership in the country. And we wanted to stabilize it. We wanted to really de-escalate from a combat situation down into a normal situation to get to eventually where we're getting to this summer and next year.
All right. And so you get out there and there's just, I mean, so much planning. We've heard about all the game planning that goes on. I mean, we hear about, you know, before a Sunday game, you got to break down the offense and break down the defense.
Scouting reports and tendencies and all that stuff, and it's almost the same thing for you guys.
Exactly. It's you try to develop game films on the folks that you're going after, and you know, so what you end up doing is you have this intel operations fusion. So we have some really really smart people that work back at the tactical operations centers, and we have information coming in, and what you're trying to do is build a target package. You're trying to figure out, okay, who's out there to hurt us and who's out there to help us. And what our goal was to find the guys and gals that were trying to hurt us and remove them from the situation and bring them in so that we could support those that were trying to help us.
And do you get intel from people can walk around and not be bothered? I mean, maybe that look like natives so they can give back to the information you guys need for that?
You get intel from everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere. So you're getting it from all kinds of different data streams. And a lot of people have this vision of warfare from, say, the Band of Brothers or different things where it's if you're at war, the bad guy's on that side of the street and you're on this side of the street, and it's clear where they are. It wasn't like that in Iraq, and it's not really like that. I mean, you're rolling down the street in a gunned up Humvee to a target, and there's kids playing soccer right next to you. It's surreal at points, and it really strikes you like there's people there just trying to get by. They're trying to live, and so you always have that in the back of your mind that hey, there's bad guys out there. They're targeting those civilians that are playing on the street as well as us, and we got to get them. But we got to get them without hurting everybody else that's around.
When you go by the kids that are playing soccer, do you beep the horn?
Look out there! Get out of the way!
Oh, that has to be almost impossible.
It's impossible for us to all imagine. Yeah. I mean, can you imagine your kids are out in front of your house? They're riding their bikes. They're playing soccer on the street, and all of a sudden, here comes a Humvee that's all gunned up,
and you're 25 yards away from engaging what you think might be the enemy and might be a deadly situation.
Absolutely. Oh.
So what happens? I mean, you get in there. It's early in the war, and the Marines are there, and the Army's there. What happens to you guys?
So we're rolling around and into different locations, and we finally get set up, and we start gathering the intel that we're looking, and we start to target some of these folks that we're hearing are making what appear to be aggressive moves against coalition forces, and one of the groups was, we'll call them the Shawarma Twins.
The Shawarma Twins.
Yeah. You know,
who comes up with that name for these guys?
Well, shawarma, if you don't know, is a local sandwich, which actually is really good, especially when you've been eating MREs for about a month.
Eating what?
MREs, meals ready to eat.
So okay.
Any
gotcha.
Change on that, you know, from the Four Fingers of Death, which is your hot dog meal, is welcome. Until you realize that there's no grassy fields out there.
Right.
These are the goats, and the whatever's providing the meat is eating basically trash.
Oh. So, but yummy.
It actually is quite tasty at first.
I'm sure. Yeah. So the Shawarma Twins own a sandwich shop.
Yeah. Yeah.
And are they actually twins?
They're not actually twins or brothers. What they are is one guy was huge. He looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the other guy looked like Danny DeVito. And and so we started referring to him as the Shawarma Twins, you know, like the movie Twins. And as you're building, that's kind of, as you start to build these packages on people, you're building this, you start to almost, I don't want to say intimate, but you start to figure out, you got to figure out where they are, what they're doing, what their patterns are, and you have to find them.
That guy's Arnold, that guy's Danny.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and so it makes it easier for us.
I don't understand. What do the sandwich shop guys have to do with anything?
So these sandwich shop guys, at this point in the war, we've now started to try to support the local economy. So, and there's some traffic in and out. Like I mentioned, you know, there's not a front line.
Are we in downtown Baghdad here?
Literally in downtown Baghdad, coalition forces are frequenting the sandwich shop. And
supporting the local
economy. They're supporting the local economy. The goal is to stabilize.
I'm walking around downtown Baghdad. I'm going to have a shawarma sandwich.
That's right.
And yeah, you know, they're doing convoys out there, and there is still a security situation. But they're literally, you know, sitting down, and again, it's warfare. It gets really surreal sometimes, and you think this is really happening. Wow, you know what? Supersize that shawarma.
Yeah. All right.
And so the information we got was these shawarma twins were out farming out for money and. From local bad guys that said, hey, we're going to try to get as many senior officers into this shop as possible, yeah. And then you can target the shop and blow the shop up. So,
how are the shawarma twins going to get out with their money?
They're just going to disappear. Once they got their cash, that it's you know, they're part of the citizenry. They can just melt away, and they could sneak out to the north, the south, or the east.
And they would have their employees blown up with all the senior military members?
Yes.
Doesn't matter to them.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, so
yes.
They're going to try and lure you guys in and blow you up.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So as we start to develop the package on these gentlemen, we find out where they live. And we start to get to the point where we realize that there's a high likelihood that they're going to engage this target earlier than we thought. So we have to do what's called a time-sensitive target. We just have to say, we know where they are, let's launch on them. And where these two gentlemen lived was the textbook version of a slum. I mean, you're talking about raw sewage running in the streets, crooked, narrow dirt roads, wires hanging from the from telephone poles that were so low that if we were trying to drive through their vehicles, it's literally our turret gunners are ducking their head, potentially, you know, could lop off their head if we're driving fast. So we have to drive a certain speed. Dogs everywhere. Sometimes rats as big as dogs everywhere.
Oh, no.
Oh yeah, huge rats. And so
could be part of that sandwich, by the way.
That shawarma sandwich may not have been goat.
Yum.
That's the special meat on Tuesday. So we get to we know that these two gentlemen, they actually live in a compound together. And a compound in this definition would be, it was probably about as big as say, four basketball courts connected. And it's about surrounded by about a 5 or 6 foot wall, glass on top of the wall, cinder block, sandstone type wall, mm-hmm. Gates on both sides. We believe that Danny lived in the big house. He had a two-story house, potentially about 1,500 square feet. And we figured Arnold lived in the small house.
So now Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger are your targets.
Yes.
The shawarma twins.
Yes. Not for real.
No.
Yes.
those were their nicknames.
This is where the lawyer comes in and this isn't really right. So, yeah, the nicknames, Danny and Arnie. And so we target them. And what we thought about was we needed to do a dual hit at the same, you know, basically hit these two guys at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we have to figure out how to get over these walls, get into a position where we can get in the house at the same time, because we weren't sure if they actually had the explosives on them so that they could just blow. If we get compromised into the target, they could just blow the target up and themselves and either our folks or innocent civilians. So as we get closer, what we end up doing is we get out of the vehicles about 100 yards from the target, and we're starting to creep up. And I have a force of about eight folks, and my target was Arnie's house, the smaller one. And the reason we went with a smaller group was it was a smaller building, and we had to basically climb over the wall and sneak through the interior of this compound to get closer to it. The larger force was going to take the bigger house, which was easier access. All they really had to do was blast through one gate. They had about a 10-foot distance to the front door, get in that door, and then they could take down the larger house. So they had about 20, 30 guys. So if you can imagine, I think in some of the other interviews guys talked about, you got about 60 pounds of gear on, and you're trying to sneak around with 60 pounds of gear on, and you're walking through, you know, everything, and you get to the wall, and it's covered with glass, and so you have to figure out a way to get over the wall, but you also have to have security, because you don't know if somebody's over there having, you know, walking out and looking at the moon. And by now it's very late. We don't go out, you know, until between, we're out in the late time frames, you know, and we vary, but we always try to stay out when everyone's asleep because it's easier to get around. So it's pitch black and you're trying to get over this wall, and you know, you have to get over, you have to wind your way over the glass, you get inside the compound, and what we had planned ahead of time was the second my guys were over the wall, I will signal the other team, and there's 90 seconds to both of us breaching our doors and getting inside. Well, as we're creeping towards the front door of our target, we're about in this inside this compound for about 15 seconds when all of a sudden the lights go on the house, the target house in Danny's house. And you hear, I can hear over the radio, compromise, compromise. That means somebody was out there and saw the larger force moving in. So I was right at the front of the train. My breacher just runs up to our target door and just slaps his demo charge on. We both step back and we clack off the charge. And we have these very, the stuff we have is just amazing. And the technology is amazing. And it blasts this door, double door, you know, solid core wood door, just turned into toothpicks, right?
So when everything basically is now exposed and the lights come on, instead of going, you know, let's back up, let's retreat, you guys say, no, screw it, let's go, blow the door.
Oh, yeah. Once you make a decision, once a SEAL element targets you and we're on you, there's no escape. We are coming. It doesn't matter what you do. We will get you. And in this situation, what you always want to do is confront some type of event with more force. So they're moving fast, we move faster. They've got bigger guns, we go get our bigger guns, or we just move outmaneuver them. Yeah. So at this point, it's get inside the house, take over the situation. So at that point, I'm blowing the door. We're having the door blown. We surge through the door, and if you can imagine the smell and the smoke, it's just this chaos. And I'm shocked because as soon as I come through the door, there's about 6 to 8 people on the ground, and they're starting to sit up. And I realize that this family, there was a family right inside the door, and they were sleeping. And as often a lot of the Iraqis, you know, don't have AC, so they sleep on the floor in the summertime because it's cooler. And right there, it's just you're thinking, oh my gosh, we just blew all these people up, and wow, they're not our targets. And sure enough, our target is in the room, and I see this big, giant mass starting to roll.
How big a guy are we talking about, Arnold?
Arnold big. He's Arnold.
He's 6'3", 250 pounds.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we didn't get close enough to figure out if it was fat or muscle, but he was a big guy. You know, and, you know, I doesn't really – can't tell on the radio, but I'm not a big guy. And you never want to tangle one-on-one with anybody anyway, so you have to launch in on these guys. And we surge in, and we're taking control of the situation, and that's the goal. Is once you get in, you're confronting, you induce this chaos. You blast a door, or you have something that induces a chaotic situation where it's dark and smoky, and that's where we are able to dominate the situation. That's where we're going in, and we go from a position of inferiority to superiority right there. And we move in on this guy, and he's starting to roll around, and we think he's starting to fight, but he's really just disoriented, thankfully, from the shockwave of that charge. And as we get to him, I have two guys on him that are pulling him off, and the rest of us are fanning out to cover down on these other individuals because we're not sure if they're children, they're going to be a threat or not. And as they roll this guy over, he is literally trying to figure out where he has an AK, a loaded AK-47 underneath his pillow. So what we ended up doing was, instead of knocking on the door or instead of retreating by being more aggressive and inducing some chaos into the situation and really getting into that target, we basically saved ourselves and the family, because if he had a chance to get that AK out and start shooting us, he would have probably just shot through the door, which happened to us on numerous occasions. Mm-hmm. And our only recourse at that point would have been, we would have had older position, we had to shoot inside and kill the family as well. So it ended up being, you know, adding explosives to the situation actually ended up making a lot of people safer. Mm-hmm. We gained control of the situation. The other house actually, they once they got in the door, it was a fairly easy takedown for them as well, just because they had such overwhelming force. And the good news story is everyone was fine. These children, you know, as I have, you know, I have younger brothers and I now I have children of my own. I could only imagine, and everyone can know what it feels like to see, like, I might have done something to hurt a child, and you pick them up, and there's literally just toothpicks in their hair from the door. And we just move them off to the side, you know, put them with their mom, say, hey, everyone, just relax.
But isn't the family yelling and screaming, like, get out or leave us alone? Yes.
It's chaos. It's always chaos. And at that point, once you dominate the situation and you secure the house, you clear through it. You've now isolated the targets. You're determining that those are, in fact, the guys you want. And you're securing the area, and you're over the radio telling your boss, hey, we're good, we're secure, we need X number of seconds. You're trying to calm everybody down. You're putting the children with their moms, and you're just trying to get, at that point, you want to get out as fast as you can.
And you guys were taking care of Arnold. What was going on with Danny?
Danny was actually fairly easy, you know. Danny heard the explosion, And Danny decided he didn't really want to play at that point. And so those guys rolled in, and again, it's overwhelming force.
Yeah.
You know, it. How many SEALs are just going to keep running through this door?
Totally,
I guess we're just going to stop.
Right?
Yeah.
And what ultimately happened to the shawarma twins? I mean, were they guys that were, and did you take them back and
extract
intel?
Or is there a chain of shawarma sandwich shops all over Baghdad now?
The best thing about these shawarma twins was they were entrepreneurs. They had sold this plan to multiple organizations, saying, "Hey, give me X number of dollars, and I'll blow up some guys." Then they go to that guy's competitor and say, "Hey, give me X number." So we had information on what we thought was initially going to be one group of bad guys targeting these. Turned out to be like five or six, which for us is great, because then we just start building target packages on them, and we start moving, and we just move out, and we fan out and take this web down.
Sounds like this shawarma twin thing was a pretty easy takedown for you guys. Didn't face much resistance, but I'm sure along the way it wasn't always this easy.
No, it's not. And that's, you know, that probably leads in good segue to my next story is what happens when you have to confront, you know, a situation where you're really getting shot at and you're still driving into this target because you have to get to this person and the situation. This is an unrelated operation, but we were actually going after another bomb maker. What we do is when we decide we're going to take down a house, we figure out how we're going to get in, whether we're going to use conventional methods or we're going to use explosives or what. And in this situation, we decided to use an explosive charge again. And what you want to do is you want to get the entry team as close to the target as possible. And the breachers we have, they have all these amazing tools. But they have to use their hands, and so they can't carry their own weapon. They'll stow their weapon as they move around, and so we send up security teams with them. And we enter this target, and if you fast-forwarded through the last story, we're basically inside the compound at this point. We're not compromised or anything, and we're inside the compound. We have about 20 folks in there waiting for their breacher to open the door, and we're going to rush through the door. We're not within sight of where the explosive breach is going to be, and all of a sudden we hear these gunshots go off, and you can easily tell the difference between AK-47 rounds and our own rounds. So I know in my head, oh wow, we just three rounds, just bam, 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 and immediately it's funny. Immediately I rush around the corner to check on my guys, and what's most encouraging is I'm almost getting knocked over as the SEALs behind
other
me.
Guys, yeah.
No, hey, our guys are getting shot. Yeah. I'm not going to stand here and wait for something else. I'm going to make something happen. And so I come around the corner, and all I see is two SEALs dragging another SEAL, which is one of the worst things you'll ever see in your life as a SEAL, dragging another SEAL backward away from this door, and the two SEALs are just laying fire into this door. Mm-hmm. But the best part is the breacher – What would happen was he was putting the charge in the door. He was kneeling down, and somebody shot, and it literally skimmed over the top of his head and took out his night vision. So,
oh my God!
Just inches above his head,
right.
And so his security element immediately started engaging into the house, but he still had the wherewithal to slap the charge on. And as he's getting dragged back, he clacks off the charge, which we hope is going to clack it off. Door will open. We'll rush in.
And how far away is he when he activates the charge?
He's probably 10 feet away.
Oh.
And in this case, the charge goes and a flash fire erupts off this charge. And there's this giant propane tank, you know, to heat and energy for the house. And it's just there's fire all over this propane tank. So as I'm running around, I see the charge go off, and I see fire shoot out. I see my guys firing, and still in my mind, I have burned in the silhouette of SEALs moving back, and the fire. And the best thing is everyone's running in, and we run right up to the door, and we get to the door, we realize that the breach didn't work. The door wasn't open all the way. It was still locked. And we're in a situation where, A, we can't get into a house, and B, someone's shooting at us, and C, there's a giant propane tank right next to us that's on fire. Oh. So rather than saying, you know, everybody run, everybody out, you just yell out, hey, secondary entry, and we zip around the house to the other door, breach that door, and at that point, you know, you can hear it to also set the scene. You know, there's smoke everywhere, there's fire, there's bullet casings on the ground. You've just breached a secondary location. You know that there's a guy who we know has bomb-making material again in the house. And we're at a point where you have to make a decision. Do you just roll out and just leave, secure it, and just call in a tank or something to disable this guy? And you think, no, we're still at a point where we can take control of the situation. You got to get through it.
And the bonus is there's a propane tank. It's on fire.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, and then, you know, and then at that point, you'll always hear, you know, cracking over the radio. Somebody's asking questions. Hey, let's focus on the situation. You know, and so you're moving through this target. And again, it's a tough situation because your adrenaline is pumping. You've got, like you said, a propane tank about to blow, and you've got to move and you've got to get up. And so now you have an active shooter. And you have to get to this guy. And so the situation that you confront is I'm about to run down a hallway and bullets are going to fly my way and we're going to be shooting down that way. And we have tactics that can do it. I'm not going to get into the specifics. The visual would be something, say, like a giant porcupine, and wherever there's spines, those are guns. Mm-hmm. And you just move down and you're just this, you know, you're just this unstoppable entity that's going to get to that hallway and get to that guy. And as we're moving in, this guy, of course, again, you have to ratchet it down. We enter on him, and me and another guy. And normally, I'm not on the entry team. I'm back in the train. In the situation, as you move down this, you have to kind of funnel into different areas to see where the target is. And mm-hmm. we come in, and sure enough, this guy who has just shot almost a whole magazine of AK-47 at us is sitting there with his gun pushed well out of his range, his hands are up, and he's just sitting there waiting for us.
So now he's going to surrender.
He's going to surrender.
And
after
he knows at that point,
shot at you.
Yeah, you're not going to shoot him and kill him.
Nope. And they know that. And so,
well,
absolutely.
You know,
well, you know, it's okay to joke. You know, yeah, it's okay to joke about that in a bar with your friends. But that's actually a good point to make about the SEALs, and that's what we do best is we ratchet up and down. You get what you deserve when you go against us. Mm-hmm. And only what you deserve. We will, if you want to attack us, we will attack you back. If you present a threat, we will meet that threat. But at a certain point, you know, we're trained to take care of these guys like that.
Wow. More stories of the Navy SEALs, Billy Ray. How'd you like those?
Oh, I loved it. That was great. Now, what happened to the propane tank?
Yeah.
So they ended up, So we focused. We secured the house, and as over the radio, I could hear my. You know, we have these Humvees, and they have all the equipment, the emergency equipment on there. And somebody ran up again. You know, it's what SEALs do. It's like, you know, these guys weren't in the fight. They were supposed to be holding security, right. And so a guy ran up with a propane tank, right up to a propane tank that's on fire, and he's got a fire extinguisher. So he takes his gun out of his hand, you know, and in order to save everybody else. He's not worried about protecting himself. He's worried about putting a fire out. And that's always something good to see.
These guys are amazing. These Navy SEAL guys are unreal. Well, Lieutenant Commander, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for telling us some war stories.
Thanks.
I'm sure all your friends from Mira Mesa High are going to be texting and calling you going, dude.
I'm never going to live down the Antarctica thing.
So dude, I went to high school with you. I didn't know you could really do all that stuff. Come on, man.
My geography teacher is going to call me.
Oh, you know where that is. That's cool.
War stories of the Navy SEALs and another $500 donation from the Great Friends Foundation to the Naval Special Warfare Foundation. Lieutenant Commander Ed Rohrbach, thank you very much for the time this morning.
Thanks for having me. We appreciate it.
Oh, man. Billy Ray still wants to come down and do the obstacle course again.
Yes.
Anytime.
Yes.
The only thing we ask is can we walk from the Buds Training Center to the obstacle course, the running through the you know, the sand?
I would just like to walk the whole course, just as a leisurely pace. That's all I'm looking for.
That's how we do it. Usually, yeah. We just, on the TV show, we do, you know. We do
you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to jump out of an airplane into Mission Bay with you guys.
I think people would be behind you on that one.
I want a parachute.
Oh, yeah. No, there will be no parachute.
Come on, seriously, how often do you guys do that now? I see these guys doing it all the time.
We get to jump. Hey, that's a perk of the job. You get to jump. You have to jump on a regular basis, monthly, in some cases.
I would love to do that. Would you do that? No, forget it. You
Come
wouldn't
on.
Do that.
I'm in. Let's
You're
go do
so
it.
You're so not in.
Just a flat-out liar.
You're so not in. Can you do that? I mean, doing the obstacle course is one thing. Will they let a civilian just jump out of an airplane?
We don't do that here.
Come on. What's a big deal?
It's, you know.
I think it's the easiest way to go, though. I mean, that's just gravity. I can do gravity.
No, you just
But
jump
I can't
out of the plane.
Run around with boats on my head and climbing ropes. I can't do that.
I would like to jump out of the plane, land in Mission Bay, and then swim out and see how you guys do it. That's what I'd like to do. No, I'm serious. Lieutenant Commander, great to be with you. Thank you so much.